Call our second case for today. 08-AP-1324, Kevin Blum Jr. versus First Auto and Casualty Insurance Company. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Blum is John Michael Riley.
Chief Justice, honorable members of the court. As I'm sure the court's well aware, we have two very fundamentally different views of how insurance contracts are to be understood. We are approaching this from the standpoint that the language is the touchstone, which has always been the rule in this state and, frankly, is something that has always recommended itself to the insurance industry, although apparently not in this case. When you look at a policy, when you look about whether there's coverage under policy, the first thing you do is you look to the language. And if the language clearly provides coverage, you go no further. If the language is ambiguous, then the rule has always been for more than 100 years that the policy is then construed in favor of the insured. And again, you need go no further. When you reach the whole question of purpose and the statute and what's said, you do that when the policy clearly on its face says there's not coverage. And now you're looking to see whether the statute somehow says you can't do that, you can't limit coverage in that fashion. You're looking to see whether there's some public policy concern that would dictate saying there should be coverage despite the language of the policy. But that's not the situation here. What we have here is language in the policy, which we believe is clear and unambiguous. It's interesting when you look at the briefing in this case at every level that no one really disputes what the language says, and no one really argues, with the exception of WIA, which I'll address later, that this language in itself, the coverage language is not clear. The language essentially says that if you're injured by the operator of a motor vehicle that does not have a policy that applies to it, then you're entitled to uninsured motorist coverage. There's no dispute that Kevin Blum was injured by the operator of a motor vehicle that did not have a policy which applied to it at that time. So the question becomes then, why didn't we stop there? In our view, you should. We think that's clear. The trial court says, yes, that's exactly what the language says, but then went off into a discussion of what it viewed as the purpose of uninsured motorist coverage, which is both unnecessary and a significant departure from the normal pattern of analysis in these cases. The Court of Appeals also did not dispute that that language was clear. What the Court of Appeals said was, well, that language is clear, but we believe there's contextual ambiguity because there's a reference to uninsured motorist in the title as well as this reference to an uninsured motor vehicle. We've cited a number of cases which say that you don't look at the title in the vehicle policy. You can look at and just as you don't do in a statute. The language of the case law is really quite clear that that's not a suitable way to establish ambiguity. You look at the substantive language that grants or denies coverage, and the substantive language in this case is clear.
Counselor, yes. My biggest problem with your argument is that you don't have two potential tortfeasors. I mean, when you look at Hull, the reason you end up with the coverage there is you have two potential tortfeasors. Here, you started out alleging that there was negligence on behalf of the vehicle owner, but then gave up on that on summary judgment. So I have a problem with applying liability insurance, which is to cover someone at fault, when you don't have two someones at fault. So that's my basic problem with your argument. Can you help me with that? And maybe I'll see your side of it if you do.
I hope so, you're right. There are two issues here. One is the fact that in this case, what we're dealing with is policy language that is different from the language in Hull. The policy language here in Hull, they were looking at a situation which said negligence on the part of the ownership, maintenance, or use. We don't have that here. Here the question is simply whether he's injured by the operator of an uninsured motor vehicle as that is defined in the policy. And that is defined in the policy as a motor vehicle which does not have a liability policy in force at the time. The company certainly could have written a policy that said you can't collect if either the owner or the operator are insured, but they didn't write that policy. And what we're requesting of the court is simply that the policy be enforced as written.
You're requesting that we enforce a liability policy against someone who you have admitted is not negligent. So what is the basis for their being liable under the liability policy? How would they fall under it?
Well, with respect to this, it's not a liability policy in a sense. It's an uninsured motorist policy, and that's what we're dealing with.
Party coverage, right? Is that what you're...
We're arguing about coverage. And so when we look at that, we don't have... what we have to do is meet the requirements of the policy. We need to come within the requirements set by the policy for an uninsured motorist claim, and we believe we've clearly done that. There's no dispute that it says that the owner or operator causes this. In this case, the operator caused it, but all it has to be is he has to cause it by using a vehicle that does not have a policy which applies to it. And clearly, this did not have a policy which applied to the vehicle.
But the reason you have uninsured motorist coverage is to put the injured person in the same position as he would have been in if the tortfeasor had a policy of his own, right?
I think there are two answers to that, Justice. One, I think that if in fact you'd have coverage on both the vehicle and the person driving, you would have gotten both of those coverages. That's the law, and that's very clear. And in fact, the vehicle policy would have been primary. So there is an uninsured motor vehicle here, and there is an operator who caused. There's no requirement in this policy that the owner of the uninsured vehicle be negligent. In the Hull case, that was a requirement because of the nature of that, the language in that policy. But we're not dealing with that language in this case, and that's what I believe the difference
okay.
is.
Okay, thank you.
So, with we believe that this should have ended at the first step. It's interesting when you see that nobody really disputes that language. The one person that does is the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance in their amicus brief, and the alliance says that, well, applies means it's relevant. And this policy, because the driver had a policy, that was relevant to the vehicle. But that was not a policy on the vehicle. The vehicle itself was clearly uninsured. The language of the policy, and indeed, if you look at it, the language of the statute is really focused on the vehicles. Policies are written on vehicles. People may operate another vehicle, but policies are written on vehicles. And in this case, there was no policy written on the vehicle. And I think that the plain meaning, if you ask the average person to read this language, say, what does that language mean? They'd say, well, the person has to be operating an uninsured motor vehicle, one that doesn't have a policy. And that's exactly what happened here. So if you apply the normal rules of construction, I think the outcome here is clear. The problem is, and I think it's a much broader problem than this case, is there's a tendency to start talking about purpose and start talking about intent. And reasonable expectations, particularly with respect to intent and reasonable expectations. Those are things that the courts have always said derive from the policy. They flow from the language of the policy. That's what we do. If we look at that policy, we say, what would a reasonable person understand by this policy?
And as we'll discuss, Riley, if I can interrupt you for a minute, and I want to get to something a little bit different, and then I'm sure you'll return to where you've been, but one of the things that's raised, as you know, in the briefs, has to do with the reducing clause, and I'm concerned about that. First of all, is it appropriate at this point for us to look at that reducing clause? Assuming it's not, that takes care of it. But assuming that it is appropriate for us to look at it, what is your position?
Well, my position is it's not appropriate to look at it, Justice, and for these reasons. First of all, clearly the rule is that if you don't raise an issue at the level below, you're not entitled to raise it on appeal. And that's the rule. There are some exceptions, but that's the rule. In this case, we have really about as an extreme example as could be imagined. This was not pled. It was not raised at the trial court. It was not raised at the Court of Appeals. It was not raised in response to the petition for review. And in fact, there was a letter from the court asking us to supplement about an issue that wasn't raised there either. So there have been at least four opportunities to raise this, none of which have been taken. Now we're at the Supreme Court. We're not only there, but we're responding to a brief, and we have very limited space, obviously, to respond. And now we get an entirely new issue. And this is not, as has been suggested by the defense, an additional rationale or a different rationale to uphold what was done at the lower level. This is a brand new defense. This is an affirmative defense that was never pled, never asserted. What the courts say is that there's going to be an exception, and there is no case that grants an exception under these circumstances. There's no case that I'm aware of that's ever granted an exception where it's already been through one level of appeal and is now at a second level of appeal. But moreover, the cases that do grant an exception say you need two things. You need, first of all, it has to have been fully briefed. It certainly has not been fully briefed. We haven't researched it. We haven't briefed it. There was no possibility of doing that in a reply brief. And secondly, and I think just as importantly, the law says that You only grant the ability to raise this issue and find it's not been waived when there is a significant public interest in the issue. The defense has argued strenuously that this issue is open and shut, which would suggest that it doesn't need to be heard. And moreover, perhaps more significantly, we now have a new statute that strikes down reducing clauses, so obviously it's not going to be an issue for the future. So to suggest that there's a significant public interest in this issue at this time, I don't think passes muster. And with respect, Justice, beyond that, honestly, we just didn't look at the issue in any detail because we didn't feel it was appropriate and we felt it would be impossible to respond.
Well, when it goes back, if it goes back, and you're getting, this was a summary judgment, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And should you prevail, it will go back for trial, I assume, right?
I presume so, Justice.
Assuming it's not settled, but if it goes back, it'll go back for trial. At trial, can they raise the reducing?
You know, I would argue that there'd be an estoppel, Justice, given, you know, among other things, just given, the imposition of the court's time, but really the imposition on our side of the case. I mean, we've now spent, you know, a great deal of time and money, obviously, going up through the Court of Appeals on the issues as they've been framed. We went through the Court of Appeals. We're now at the Supreme Court. It's always a pleasure to be here, but it takes some time to do that. And the notion that the defense should now be able at this stage to raise a brand new issue, I just don't think passes muster, and I don't think it will with the trial court either. Assuming that I haven't thought carefully about whether or not that they could raise that at the trial court, but assuming they do, I think we would have a strong argument.
Counselor, is your definition in the policy of uninsured motorists any different than what's set out in 632.324A?
It is, Justice, and the difference is that there's no definition there of uninsured motor vehicle, but there is in our policy. So it is a significant difference because there they talk about an uninsured motor vehicle, but they don't define it in the way that we do here. The new statute does have a definition, but the prior statute did not.
I guess what I was looking at is said that uninsured motorist is the protection for persons injured, quote, who are legally entitled to recover damages from owners or operators of uninsured motor vehicles. And I'm back again on the problem I have in that I don't see how you're legally entitled to recover damages from the owner of this car.
But we don't need to be, Justice. It says owner or operator, and in Hull, this court decided that those things were, any of those would suit. So here we have owner or operator.
Well, there are two different people in this case, but in Hull, they both were tortfeasors. There was a negligent entrustment. So there was a legal opportunity, at least, to recover from the owner of that vehicle.
I don't disagree with, I think it was negligence with respect to maintenance, Justice, but I don't disagree with the point that you're making. But that had specific, that court, the Hull court, your court was addressing the specific language there, which said ownership, maintenance, or use. And the court fixed on maintenance and said, well, there was negligence with respect to maintenance. But it's also important, I think, Justice, to when we talk about Hull, Hull did what we're advocating that the court do here. It looked at the language first, and it addressed that language, and it found coverage based on the language. It did not find the language ambiguous. The court then went on to talk about 632.324, but it didn't reach its decision based on that. It said that we're going to make this decision based on the language. We don't really need to reach 632, but we think it might be helpful to do it, so we will. But there's nothing in Hull that's inconsistent with what we're asking. In fact, we think it's perfectly consistent because it's a language-based decision, which is precisely what we think this should be.
Thank you.
Let's turn to ambiguity. If we get that, you know, again, we don't believe that there's we don't believe this ambiguous, believe it's clear, but we understand that there's an argument with respect to ambiguity. The Court of Appeals said that this was ambiguous. The trial court really didn't address it, sort of, but I think by implication suggested it was. And the defense has essentially agreed that the policy is ambiguous. At least they have not disputed that. So what happens when you have ambiguity? The rule really is crystal clear and has been for over 100 years. This rule goes back to 1898, and the rule is simple. If there's an ambiguity, it's construed against the drafter, construed against the insurance company. It's ambiguous if there's more than one reasonable interpretation. Obviously, the Court of Appeals said there was more than one reasonable interpretation, and so does the defense here. So the question is, why wouldn't we apply that rule? If you look at the rule, this Supreme Court has enunciated that rule in over 60 cases, Court of Appeals over 60 times. Seventh Circuit seven times, district court, federal districts 16 times. There's really no rationale that's offered for disregarding the rule here, except cites to two treatises. One's Corbin on Contracts, and another one is an insurance treatise that's frankly kind of an insurance industry tract. But leaving that aside, what they're saying is that you can ignore this, and in fact, this rule should be sort of the last resort. That's what the defense argues in this case. And they argue that based on Section 559 of Corbin on Contracts, which I have before me. What this section says is this. It says, first of all, you look at how the contracts were formed, and you look at what kind of agreements and understandings and principles in the industry. It doesn't deal with an insurance contract to begin with, and it's clear from the language that's true, and they discuss insurance contracts briefly later. But what they say is you look at all those things to see whether or not a contract was formed. And here's what they say. If, however, it is clear that the parties tried to make a valid contract and the remaining doubt as to the proper interpretation is merely as to which of two possible and reasonable meanings should be adopted, the court will adopt that one which is the less favorable in its legal effect to the party who chose the words. Corbin supports our position. It supports over a century of law in Wisconsin. It does not support the notion that we should disregard a rule of that, that sort of that lineage and that length. It just doesn't support that in any way. In the
Mr. Riley, I'd like to, if I might, interrupt you again for a minute.
No, that's fine, Justice.
Looking at the Court of Appeals opinion, the Court of Appeals relied heavily, as you know, on Hemmerly, which was a case that this court specifically overruled in the Hull case. Do you have any comment or reaction to that kind of an approach by the Court of Appeals?
Yes, Justice, I do. I think it's inappropriate. And what the court said is, first of all, that anything that isn't expressly overruled is somehow retains precedential value. And first of all, I think that ignores Hull. I mean, Hull overruled the case in its entirety. In this particular case, Hull says, as you know, you authored it, says very expressly, we're not limiting this to its facts. We're just overruling this. The other thing that's problematic in terms of saying Hemmerly retains some kind of precedential value, the approach taken by the court in Hull is distinctly at odds with Hemmerly. In Hemmerly, the court didn't look to the language at all. It looked first to the statute and the purpose of the statute and said, well, because we view the purpose of the statute this, we think the statute's ambiguous. But here's how we're going to construe that statute. And based on that, we're going to say that the average person somehow should be aware of the statute, aware of our construction of the statute, and should therefore only reasonably expect the coverage allotted by statute rather than look to the language of the policy. I think that is inconsistent with years and years of precedent in our state. I think it's completely inconsistent with what the Hull court, what your court did in Hull. And so I don't think that should retain precedential value specifically for those reasons. I also think it's equally important that if we're going to have rules made, this court is supposed to be the court that says they're supposed to correct errors. This court establishes the law in this state. If you accept the premise that they're operating on, then every time this court goes through a case, it's not free to simply say we're overruling this and offer one or two reasons. It has to parse every line in that decision and say, okay, and we're going to overrule this, and we're going to overrule this, and we're going to overrule that. And I simply think that places an unreasonable burden on the court. You know, if we're going to establish precedent, which is vitally important to all of us, it ought to be deliberately and not by inadvertence. And they're really that's what they're arguing for, that if you happen to miss a point that this court doesn't agree with or that this court doesn't need to reach, then somehow that retains precedential value. I think that's an invidious doctrine and not one that this court should adopt. And I know that I don't think that's been made clear. I think this is a good opportunity to do it. So we believe strongly that the court should apply that if we get past the initial argument, don't think it's necessary. If we do, then clearly there's ambiguity. Nobody disputes that. There is nobody here other than WIA, who we already dealt with. Nobody here disputes that this is ambiguous. And incidentally, it's interesting that WIA claims that there's a particular construction that should be placed on it, but it's not a construction that the trial court placed on it, that the Court of Appeals placed on that language, or that the defense, in fact, is placed on that language. So the notion that that's what a reasonable person ought to take from that language is a little difficult to believe when you look at the what's happened in this case today. I think it is the approach we've taken to analyzing policy language and to determining coverage under the policy really is critically important. I mean, it's an approach that we've all relied on for years. It's an approach generally that the industry has championed. I mean, this is a contract and agreement between two parties. And what we all are seeking is to enforce what the parties intended. And what we have, the courts have said for years, is that that intent and those expectations are to be found in the words of the policy. When you think about the consequences of just abandoning this decades of precedent, you know, now you're going to cut yourself adrift from this language so that in every single case, are we then going to discuss what the purpose of something is, you know, what the underlying, what people's expectations were, totally divorced from the language of the policy? It also would suggest that we're now going to enshrine the statutes as kind of the rule, and we're going to read these policies as coterminous with the statutes. But that's not the rule either, and we're all aware of that. Statutes set floors. They say that you can't go below this. This is what we require of you. The company then is free to draft the policy so long as it doesn't fall below that floor, and they can draft the policy as they choose. In this case, the company clearly could have drafted a policy that said what they would now like it to say, which is we will only be responsible if both the owner and the operator of a vehicle are uninsured. That's a simple fix. The company has made a big thing about this tidal wave of litigation that's going to engulf the industry. I note with interest that the same argument was made in Hull not too long ago, and it's been made pretty much every time we get up and start talking about insurance coverage issues. You know, the simple fact is this. One, they can draft around this issue very easily if they want to. Two, and I think this is significant, if you look at this issue, what we're asserting here is that there is uninsured motorist coverage because of the language, and that language is based on the fact that the vehicle was uninsured. If the roles were reversed, if we had somebody, the driver was uninsured but the vehicle was insured, it's, I think, abundantly clear that what we'd be hearing from the other side is that, well, clearly there's no coverage there, and quite honestly, I don't think I'd have any response for that because I think that's true. We're relying on the definition, and the definition focuses on the vehicle. And so I think that is critically important. And it also suggests that there is not this flood tide of litigation to ensue. I would also know, I think there are two cases, maybe three, who have addressed this issue in, you know, the last 50 years. So the notion that there's lots of these out there just waiting, I think, just doesn't bear inspection.
Counselor, doesn't Part CA of your policy specifically say we will pay compensatory damages, which an insured is legally entitled to recover from the owner or operator of an uninsured vehicle? And then it says the owner or operator's liability for these damages must arise out of ownership, maintenance, or use of the vehicle. To me, it sounds just like the statute you and I were talking about. And so I had my clerk get me the policy because I hadn't read it since I read the initial briefs. I don't see how your policy doesn't require that the owner be liable.
Well, I think it's, and I don't know how much further I can go, Justice, but with respect, I mean, what the policy says is that if there is an owner or operator of an uninsured motor vehicle, this person is the operator of an uninsured motor vehicle. We are entitled to recover. Nobody disputes that there's an entitlement to recover. The question is, are we entitled to recover under an uninsured motorist coverage? And that's dictated by the language of the policy. And all we need to show is that there's an operator and that this vehicle is uninsured. And this vehicle is uninsured. I don't think anybody disputes that. And that's the difference, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anything unique about this language to this policy?
I don't think it's unique, Justice. I disagree with the defense that every policy is drafted this way. That's not so. I mean, we know that the policy in Hull, for instance, wasn't drafted this way. So, you know, I don't think that's true. But is there something highly unusual about it? That's not our argument that this is somehow highly unusual, but I don't frankly think it matters whether this policy is unique or is drafted the way many policies are drafted if we comply with the language as we believe we have. And I think at best, even the defense concedes at best, we've got an ambiguity. They don't argue that the language clearly bars us from recovery here. And once we get to the ambiguity stage, there is simply no reason not to enforce the rule which says that when you draft a policy, it's going to be construed against you and the insured, you know, will be preferred. That's been the rule for a century, and frankly, if we accept what the defense says, they're simply going to overturn that rule in preference for an analysis that goes into all sorts of extrinsic issues, which frankly is going to lend itself to just chaos. We're going to have this come up again and again and again, and frankly, I would think the industry would be concerned that on their side, now they're going to be faced with all these arguments that we can sort of ignore the policy language and just turn to extrinsic resources whenever it suits our purposes to do that. And I don't think that's the law. I don't think it would be a constructive thing at all. Ultimately, I'm sorry, I have a red light. Would you like me to finish one quick thought? Or
finish your quick thought.
I'll make it quick. The other thing, problem with Emerly is the notion that we're going to establish reasonable expectation, not by the language, but by looking at, you know, the statute and decisions construing it, in this case, decisions overruling those decisions, and then other decisions commenting on those decisions, is something that I think no one wants to see. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Rick J. Mundt, representing First Auto and Casualty Insurance Company.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Riley, assembled guests. I'm Rick Mundt. It's my pleasure to present the case today on behalf of First Auto. Petitioner's position in this case, that uninsured motorist coverage is available without regard to or establishment of fault, is unprecedented in the body of uninsured motorist coverage in this state and nationwide. Majority of courts that have considered this issue in the uninsured context have concluded that with an insured driver and uninsured owner, UM coverage is unavailable. A minority of courts, including this court, through the Hull decision, have held that uninsured motorist coverage applies in the joint tortfeasor insured operator uninsured owner context, because such coverage is activated when either the owner or driver is uninsured. No court, however, construing what has become increasingly uniform definitional and coverage language, has found that which the petitioner asked the court to do in this case, legal entitlement to UM uninsured motorist benefits based upon uninsured vehicle ownership without regard to fault. What the petitioner asks this court to do is transform that which has been long known as uninsured motorist coverage into uninsured motor vehicle coverage. Stripped to its essence, this case asks, what is uninsured motorist coverage and how can it apply when the motorist is insured? To understand that question, justices, it's beneficial to look at what is the purpose of UM or uninsured motorist coverage. As I believe Justice Rogenczak pointed out, uninsured motorist coverage serves as an uninsured tortfeasor's liability insurance when liability coverage is unavailable to the person who ought to pay. That is the law. That is what the language of the First Auto policy tracks. What uninsured motorist coverage is not is that which the petitioner would ask the court to find, and that is, it is not a stacked layer of liability coverage for an insured tortfeasor motorist, and it is not no fault or strict liability coverage for an uninsured vehicle owner. The purpose of uninsured motorist coverage is to take someone such as an insured Kevin Bloom in this particular case, and put him in the same place as if the uninsured motorist had liability coverage.
Counsel, could you take, normally we don't get purpose unless we need an aid to interpretation. I know that you are advocating the framework of analysis of the Court of Appeals. It appears to me that you are. But if you would embrace the framework of analysis, that is, if language is ambiguous, you construe it in favor of coverage. Embracing that framework of analysis, can you make an argument that you prevail?
Let me start out by the premise.
Counsel, you'll have to stand in front of the microphone. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Let me start with your premise, and that is that I am embracing the analysis of the Court of Appeals. First, Auto embraces the result. I don't necessarily embrace the analysis of the Court of Appeals.
If I may, I respond, fair enough, and thanks for that clarification. What I'm interested, and I appreciate that.
Sure.
What I really am interested in is, tell me, using the analysis of ambiguity, if there's ambiguity, tie goes to coverage. Using that analysis, how do you prevail?
If I understand the question, presuming or assuming that the premise is that there is ambiguity, how do we then get to the position of First Auto? Am I understanding?
Do you think there's ambiguity in this policy? Your opposing counsel in his comments said, even at best, defense agrees there's ambiguity. Maybe, do you agree?
I do not. And I'll tell you why, if I can. Can I diverge there, Justice?
Please.
I do not believe there's ambiguity. Looked at in a vacuum, accepted as a snippet, the passage that the petitioner relies upon might appear to be ambiguous. We know that that is not the way that we interpret contracts, and insurance policies are contracts. We interpret them in the broad context of the policy as a whole.
Four corners.
We look at everything. Contextual ambiguity, no.
We look at the four corners of the policy.
That's correct, and I'm going to assist you with the four corners, if I might, Justice Bradley.
Please.
The four corners of the policy don't speak only to the passage that the petitioners would have the court focus upon. The four corners of the policy would start as a reasonable insured understanding what his expectations or her expectations might be with the declarations. And in looking at the declarations, what is the insured told? He looks at his declarations and he sees, do I have uninsured motor vehicle coverage? He's told, no, I have uninsured motorist coverage. Continuing on, because we're
depending on whether the declaration is a part of the policy or whether it says declarations are not part of the policy.
Okay, let me continue on because we're still looking at the four quarters. That is part of the policy. But continuing on, we then look at this particular coverage part. As the court knows, we're talking about Part C. That is identified not as uninsured motor vehicle coverage. It is identified as uninsured motorist. Part C, uninsured motorist. Continuing on, is there ambiguity or not? And I'm going to explain to you why I think there is not when we look at it four corners as a whole. Continuing on, you look at the entirety of that coverage part, Part C, in the coverage grant, in the limits of liability, in the exclusions, there are, I believe, seven separate references to uninsured motorist coverage. Nowhere in the policy, UM coverage or elsewhere, is there a single reference to uninsured motor vehicle coverage? Back to your Honor's question then. When you look at this as a whole, what would the reasonable insured's expectation be? Not looking in a vacuum at a snippet, but looking at the policy as a whole, looking at the entirety of the pertinent coverage part, Part C, his expectation would be, I have in fact purchased and am afforded uninsured motorist coverage. Does that address your question, Justice Bradley?
Yes.
I'll continue then. Thank you.
Mr. Mundt, since you're talking about Part C, I'd like to talk a little bit further about Part C of the policy. When I look at Part C and I look at A, it says we will pay compensatory damages which an insured is legally entitled to recover from the owner or operator of an uninsured motor vehicle. It then goes on in Part C, but number C, to say uninsured motor vehicle means a land motor vehicle to which no bodily injury liability bond or policy applies at the same time of the accident. So it really isn't quite correct, is it, to say that it's all about uninsured motorists? Because, first of all, you're talking about the owner or operator of an uninsured motor vehicle in A, and in C, there's a definition saying uninsured motor vehicle means a land motor vehicle to which no bodily injury, liability, bond, or policy applies. Now, it seems to me that, indeed, it's not so simple to say, oh, this is all about uninsured motorists. It seems to me the language is very definitely tied to the idea of an uninsured motor vehicle.
It speaks to the definition, Justice Crooks, of an uninsured motor vehicle. It doesn't ever speak to, and there is never a reference to, a coverage that is bound to the uninsured motor vehicle, number one. Number two, I would direct the court to, and this was not an argument that was presented by the respondents, it was actually brought out in the amicus brief filed by the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance. And I think it is with merit. And that is, if you look at the definition, which Your Honor has just pointed us to, it speaks to an uninsured motor vehicle being a land motor vehicle to which no bodily injury liability policy applies at the same time of the accident. The amicus brief of the Insurance Alliance, I believe, has effectively addressed that definitional issue. And I believe, definitionally, we can establish that in this particular case, the Blum vehicle was not an uninsured motor vehicle. And if you recall the amicus brief from the Insurance Alliance, it talks about what it means to speak of a policy applying to a motor vehicle. And it speaks of a policy being pertinent or relevant. The amicus brief tells us that there is more than one way for liability insurance to provide coverage for a motor vehicle. One is where the motor vehicle is specifically identified in the declarations as an insured vehicle. The other way, not addressed in the petitioner's submissions to the court, is that it in fact is not identified as a specifically covered auto, but that it falls within the class of vehicles for which a tortfeasor's activities are covered by the liability policy.
Let me go a little bit further, because you're now talking about the amicus brief, which I think is appropriate to talk about. There's two of them, of course, here. But talking about the Insurance Alliance amicus brief, my recollection is that they raised the issue of the reducing clause, and I know you've taken a position in that regard as well. What is your position today in regard to the reducing clause? Is that something we should be looking at this court?
You're going to allow me to get to it a little bit earlier than I had planned to, but the answer to the question in shorthand...
I'll always try to be accommodating.
Thank you. The answer in shorthand is yes. Let me, if I might, Justice Crooks, touch upon that at this point. I want to correct, and I'm certain that Mr. Riley just overlooked this. In fact, the issue of the reducing clause is one that has been before this court for over a year. The reducing clause was raised in the respondent's response to the petition for review. It was there over a year ago. So I do believe it appropriate to take up. I don't believe that we're caught in a situation of surprise, and I don't know that Mr. Riley was suggesting that, but this is something that has been, for lack of a better term, percolating for perhaps a year.
Was it brought up in the circuit court?
It was not, Your Honor.
Was it brought up in the Court of Appeals?
It was not.
Okay. Usually, forfeiture of a defense relates to what happened at the trial court, because the theory is that you're supposed to tell the trial court so the trial court can rule on it, and if it's a winner, it never gets any further. So bringing it up here is good, but not quite significant in the rule of forfeiture.
It may not be timely, I think, is what we're discussing here, Justice. Let me explain why I think it is appropriate, and I recognize that is the general rule. As the Chief is clearly aware, there is also exceptions
yes.
carved to that general rule.
Right, and this court, if it wants to, can handle the issue.
Correct.
Right?
The court could take it up on its own without me even briefing it. It could have been one of those things where clerks or the justices themselves look at this and they say, wait a minute, we have a narrow judicial restraint basis for deciding this, not brought up, by the petitioner, not brought up by the respondent. We can take it up on our own. You can do that on your own, or if I bring it up. Why do I think it's appropriate in this case, even though we did not follow the general rule that requires that issues that we intend to discuss on appeal be briefed, be presented, and be considered and determined by the lower courts? I think we've touched upon it in our brief, Justice, and I'll only explain to you why that is. This, as the case comes to this court, is almost perfectly postured to fit into the exception to the general rule. We have an issue that is being brought up by the respondent, not by the petitioner. We have an issue that is one and appropriate for summary judgment. It's one on the law only. There is no dispute of the law. And I think most importantly, it fits within that which the Insurance Alliance's brief suggested is in fact one of the cardinal rules of this court, and that is to decide cases on the narrowest ground possible, exercising the principle of judicial restraint. All of those reasons compel consideration of the reducing clause at this juncture, even though not timely brought up in the trial court.
You think we would have taken this case on the issue of this reducing clause?
I've given that some thought, Justin.
I bet. We didn't even know that it existed when we took the case.
Well, I think you did because it was in fact addressed in our petition. It was addressed in our response to the petition. So, in fact, it was there. The answer to your question is not likely. But I'm not certain that that is dispositive, Justice Bradley, because, frankly, I think it is an issue that the court is obligated to now consider, and it is, in fact, dispositive.
Don't you think saying we're obligated to consider it is pushing the envelope just a little bit?
I do.
Yeah.
I think it would be appropriate for the court to take it up at this juncture, Justice Bradley. And let me explain, and I think this was actually brought up in one of the questions addressed to Mr. Riley, and I have a slightly different spin on it from that which Mr. Riley offered. If, in fact, this case is reversed and it goes back down to the trial court, I think it quite likely that this is going to be an issue that the trial court will be presented in some sort of dispositive fashion. I don't think that you're going to stick a dagger in the reducing clause and it'll never be heard from again in this case, because if it's reversed and it goes back down, it's a viable issue that should be presented and I believe would be dispositive. I can get into further if Justice Crooks would like to hear about my thinking on the merits of the reducing clause as well. I understood your question to be, is it appropriate for the court to take up now?
Yeah, that really was my question. And if you will, I've got one more question that I asked of opposing counsel and I'd like to ask of you. I listened carefully when you indicated that you didn't necessarily agree with the approach taken by the Court of Appeals. As you know, there's some interest in the members of this court, from the members of this court, in regard to a situation such as Howell when we reversed or overruled Hemmerly, and then the Court of Appeals relying heavily on Hemmerly. Do you have any position in that regard?
Any position on the propriety of the court relying?
That's appropriate, because you indicated you were not necessarily agreeing with the approach taken by the Court of Appeals in answer to a question from Justice Bradley.
And I think I've explained that, but let me make it perhaps clear. The Court of Appeals found the language ambiguous. I think I've quite unequivocally stated, for the reasons that I've articulated, and I'm happy to do so again, I don't believe it is ambiguous. When it's looked at in the four corners, when it's looked at in the complete context, not taken out of context, not taken in a vacuum, not taken in a snippet, but when it's looked at in the complete context of the policy, I do not believe it is ambiguous. That is where the respondent's position before this court parts with the analysis of the Court of Appeals, Justice Crooks. Does that answer your question?
Well, let me ask it more directly. Obviously, there seems to be some concern with this court and with the Court of Appeals in terms of what is the effect of overruling a decision of the Court of Appeals. Is there still some life left in that Court of Appeals decision? so that they can use it later, as was used in the Court of Appeals opinion here. Do you have any position on that? Is that appropriate for the Court of Appeals to do? Is that an issue that this court should be concerned about? And is that an issue that we ought to address in an opinion here?
Multiple, that's more direct.
Multiple questions.
Yeah, absolutely. But they all
let me see if I can parse them and tease them out, if I might. Should this court be concerned about ruling in this case and how it might impact the lower courts, that is, the Court of Appeals ruling here, if it were to overrule? Is that one of...
No, I'm most concerned with the approach taken by the Court of Appeals in relying heavily on an opinion that was overruled by this court in Hull, that being the Hemmerly case. And whether or not that's something that you think we ought to address, whatever we do in this opinion, for you or against you, is that an issue that should be addressed by this court?
Well, I'm going to respond to it by perhaps giving you a politician's response, and that is, if in fact you look at the reducing clause, which we would advocate that you do, based upon judicial restraint and based upon finding a basis for decision on the narrowest possible ground, then you don't. But let me finish. Okay, I do think that that is some concern, that they relied upon a decision and, in fact, attempted to explain why they were doing so in a fashion that seemed inconsistent with this court's ruling in Hull that specifically overruled the Hemmerly case. I do find that to be a concern. More importantly, I think the answer to your question is, should this court be concerned about that? I think the answer is yes.
Counsel, you know, what's going on here, and probably because you're not in our internal discussions and maybe don't read every single footnote in every single case, is a policy concern for our court. In the federal courts, when the Supreme Court overrules a circuit court decision, it overrules the issue. It talks about the rest of the case can be cited. And if you look on Westlaw, you'll say overruled in part, or some parts of it still has no precedential value. Westlaw treats our cases the same way, as does Wisconsin Courts of Appeal. They believe they can use parts of cases that are not directly overruled or necessarily overruled. And we have a concern about whether, when we overrule a case, we should say that case is foreboding from ever being cited or anything again, which is different than the federal rule. So what we're trying to get from you is a little bit of guidance as a practitioner on how you would view the rule as it's been used by the Court of Appeals, though never approved by this court, or whether we should take a very direct stance and say in this opinion, henceforth, any case we overrule can never be cited for any reason in any future case. That's what you're being asked to address.
Thank you. You've asked me to join in commenting
giving
upon
us some guidance on
comment
that.
Upon the institutional administration of the courts, and I appreciate the invitation to do so.
That's what we're doing.
From if the question is from a practitioner's standpoint, would that be beneficial? I think the answer is yes.
Okay.
I think it would be. And I think Mr. Riley would probably share in that as well. Clearly, the more bright line distinctions we have as practitioners, the easier is our practice going to be. And I think that's where the question is going.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, you can argue then you are going to be opening up a lot of legal issues that may also have been decided in that case that this court never looked at. So you'll be saying, well, you know, maybe the Court of Appeals decided two different things in the case. And the second one was dispositive, so they had to decide the first one to get to the second one. But you can no longer use that opinion for the first one either. So now you have another open legal issue. So it does run both ways, and there are lots of facets on it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Counselor? Is the canon of construction that if an insurance policy is ambiguous, it should be construed in favor of the insured. Do you believe that that's a correct statement of the law?
I believe it is. If you are asking me, is it an absolute, and I'm going to follow up, I believe the answer is no. As you've posited it to me, it is a correct statement of the law. Is it unyielding, and are there no exceptions? I believe the answer to that is no, and we've addressed that in our brief. And specifically, if I might follow up on that, Justice Bradley, the court in interpreting contracts and an insurance policy as such is obviously attempting to divine, if you will, the reasonable expectations of the parties to the contract. The law is clear, and we've cited it in our brief, and there's any number, that is, in so attempting to divine, this court is to reject interpretations that would lead to absurd or unreasonable results. That is the respondent's position here. If, in fact, the court were to find that this policy language is ambiguous, you have to go beyond that. You cannot say automatically, as the justice has asked me, do we then immediately defer to saying it has to be construed against the drafter? We do not, because you have to look at whether in so doing the result would be unreasonable or absurd. And it's our position, as we've outlined in our brief, that that would be the result if, in fact, the court were to find, looked at in a vacuum, this narrow snippet of language to be ambiguous. Ultimately, the result would be unreasonable and absurd.
So in the many decisions, I have 11 or 12 in the last 2 years, where our court has said if an insurance contract is ambiguous as to coverage, it will be construed in favor of the insured. In the Freighter case, in the Lasowski case, in the Wingard case, in the Sustish case, in the Stewart case, in the Leibovich case, in the Acuity versus Bagadia case, written by most of the justices on this court in the last 2 years, where we've reiterated that we should always be saying, but there are exceptions to that. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying you should be saying that, Justice.
We should be thinking it?
I think that that has to be part of the analytical framework. That is clearly not just what Rick Month thinks. That's what the law tells us. That has to be part of the justice's analytical framework, is whether or not we have to go beyond first base and continue around the paths to take
Let me take a freighter. I'm sorry. Please finish your sentence.
It's okay.
My mind was ahead of my manners. I'm sorry. Freighter. If an insurance contract is ambiguous as to coverage, it will be construed in favor of the insured, citing State Farm versus Landridge. Insurers had the advantage over insureds because they draft the contracts. Thus, courts construe ambiguities in coverage in favor of the insured. And that kind of language has shown up last year 4 times in our opinions, in 2008, 5 times in our opinions.
I concede all the above, Justice. My point, and I think I've made it, but I'll make it one more time, is I don't believe that that is where the law tells us the inquiry has to necessarily end. That, in fact, it's not appropriate to end it there if, in so doing, what we are creating, what the court is creating, is an unreasonable or absurd result. Why is it unreasonable and absurd? For the very reason that I articulated at the outset. The purpose of uninsured motorist coverage is uncontroverted, and it's to deal with a situation where one is legally entitled to recover from an uninsured tortfeasor. The Hull case.
So our paradigm or our framework of analysis should not end with language like insureds have the advantage insurers have the advantage over insureds because they draft the contracts. Court will construe ambiguities in favor of the insureds. And we should add, as long as it doesn't, we should add another leg to that analysis then.
I don't want to tell the court how they should be writing their opinions, but in terms of,
I think
what I've stated is I think it's appropriate for the analytical model employed by the court to do exactly that which the law has told us. And that is, if in fact the result in so applying that Hornbook law would lead to an absurd or unreasonable result, then it is appropriate to consider further. Let me, if I might, Justice Bradley, and I want to get into this because this really is at the nub of what
Am ambiguity, you see, you can't get to absurd result, really. Ambiguity, the definition of ambiguity, is there two reasonable interpretations. It wouldn't be ambiguous if it was absurd. As long as there are two reasonable interpretations, our law is, and it has been stated by every justice in this court in the last 2 years, save one, in opinions and in multiple opinions, just as I stated. So you don't get to ambiguity unless it is reasonable. At least a couple of the alternatives are reasonable. If it was absurd, it wouldn't be ambiguous. That's the framework of analysis. I go in my mind, bing, 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 bing. And that's your response. You don't have, if it's ambiguous, it's construed, which means two reasonable interpretations, it's construed in favor of the insured as long as the construction isn't absurd. That's not the framework.
Let me, and I enjoy these semantic discussions. Let me,
semantic,
if I might.
Semantic, but vital.
Agreed, vital. I'm not disputing, and I don't believe the respondent disputes, that we have two reasonable interpretations, hence the court's ambiguity. What we do not have, though, is a reasonable result.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let me, if I can, going back to the comment that I made at the outset and then tying this back to where we were, and if I might, I see that my red light is on. May I
finish? Yes, indeed. And
may I finish my comment then, please, Justice?
As long as your comment is a few sentences,
it
absolutely.
Will be. Thank you. I direct the court to your decision and this language from Hull because I think it's salient and I think it's dispositive. Accordingly, Hull is entitled to UM coverage under the terms of her policies if, as alleged, the truck was not insured by its owner for bodily injury liability and had been negligently maintained by him. There is no reason for this consequent statement in the law regarding uninsured vehicle ownership, if uninsured vehicle ownership without more would be necessary to establish uninsured motorist coverage. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Riley, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Before you start, let me state the obvious. That is, the Chief Justice is not here. She had to leave for a matter, but she wanted to make sure that I advised that she will listen to the tapes over the remaining.
I just want to note that she left during Mr. Mutt's presentation.
But she's also absent during your rebuttal.
That's true. That's true, Justice.
To them and hear your wisdom. You may proceed, Mr. Riley.
I think that the point that you made, Justice, really is a critical one. I mean, by definition, you have two reasonable interpretations, and Mr. Mutt says he doesn't really dispute that. If that's true, you can't say that it's an absurd result to enforce one of those interpretations. It's not. It's what the law requires that we do. You know, I'd also note that through much of this discussion, we're back to this same just fundamental dichotomy between what the two of us view. I believe, and I think our law clearly states, that we construe contracts the way they're drafted. The first thing we do is to enforce the way they're drafted. If it's clear, if it's not clear, then we apply the rules of construction. What we don't do is start looking at purpose and all sorts of other extrinsic things when the language of the policy is either clear or ambiguous. And certainly one of those two things is true here, even on the defense posture. I don't see how we get past that rule. To me, we should have stopped right at the beginning, because I think it is clear language which grants coverage. With respect to Hull, the difference is pretty clear. Hull is a language-driven decision, just as this should be. And in Hull, the decision was based on different language, and it did require that ownership maintenance, as the court determined that maintenance was negligent. That was required under the Hull decision. It is not required here because this definition does not require that. What this definition says is that you're injured by the operator of an uninsured motor vehicle, which is defined as one which does not have a policy in force, does not have a policy which applies. The notion that this policy applies thing makes sense. I mean, one, even the defense didn't raise that in their brief. The trial court never said that. The Court of Appeals has never said it. The notion that the average person would somehow clearly understand that language means unequivocally, that it's pertinent to because somebody else is driving, It talks about an uninsured motor vehicle. This vehicle did not have a policy in force. The operator of the vehicle did have a policy, but that's an entirely different thing. And to try to twist that language to somehow fit, make it crystal clear that there was no coverage just doesn't work. I mean, it makes no sense at all. You can't disregard the critical coverage language. The argument that they're making essentially is, well, there are these references to uninsured motorist coverage, and that is a generic term that's used in the industry. It's used in the statute. There's no question about that. But when you look to see what's covered, what you look at is the coverage language, and that's the language that we rely on, is that coverage language. I think it's clear. I don't think the reference to uninsured motors makes it ambiguous, but if it does render it ambiguous, you know, you still have coverage under the rules that we have applied for more than a century in this state. In terms of the reducing clause, let me address that quickly. You know, one, I'm not at all clear that this is an enforceable defense if it goes back to the trial court. I think what may well happen is there's only one issue that was raised at the trial court, and that was what the issue that we're here to argue. If that issue is resolved in our favor, I think that may well end the case. But whatever happens, they certainly cannot meet the tests that have been set. One, there's no case that allows this to happen where you go through the trial court, through the Court of Appeals, and then finally raise this when you get to the Supreme Court, whether it's in the petition for review or in their brief. Secondly, the standards are that you'd have to have a significant public interest. They claim the law is clear on this issue, and in any event, the statute has now changed. So there's no significant public interest in addressing this issue, and it certainly has not been fully briefed, as the court is well aware. They spent some time on it. We spent none. We didn't really have the opportunity to do that. The policy that this gentleman was driving had was his policy. It wasn't a policy on the car. That car had no policy. There's really no dispute about that at all. There's a suggestion, a statement up front by Mr. Munt that what we're advocating is coverage without fault. That's not true at all. There has to be fault on the part of the operator, and there was fault on the part of the operator, but it's fault on the part of the operator of an uninsured motor vehicle, and we have exactly that here. There's no dispute for purposes of this motion that he was at fault. There's no dispute that this vehicle did not have a policy which applied to it at the time of the accident. So those conditions are met, and that does not exonerate people from fault. It doesn't convert it into another liability policy. It does exactly what the policy says it will do. It grants the coverage that the company chose to grant by the language they selected, and it's commonplace that the cases say again and again that when you draft a policy and you draft it with any lack of clarity, you can't be heard to complain later that you're now somehow being held to a risk that you didn't contemplate. I mean, the company's aware of these decisions. The company's aware of the law certainly far better than any individual could be, and the company can draft their policies if they choose to eliminate these risks. The company didn't choose to do that. They drafted a policy with particular language, and that language ought to be enforced. Ultimately, I'm done. If you want, I'll take 1 second to talk about the issue that we've raised several times about. This case is the poster child for not granting precedential value to cases that have been overruled. I think if you look at what happened here, the Court of Appeals made what I believe was clearly an error, and they made it in reliance on a decision because their view was that decision hadn't been overruled in its entirety. I think we'd have all been far better off had they viewed that decision as being overruled in its entirety. And I think that not to do that, and I agree with Mr. Munn completely, and I think not to impose a rule that does that really creates great risk for everyone. As a practitioner, I'd far rather just say that's been overruled, that's that, and not have to then have a big battle over what parts of it were overruled and what parts of it still have precedential value. Thank you.
Thank you, counselors, for interesting arguments in this case. We are in recess until 1:30, if that works with everyone. And court with class will be back soon.